Coming to you from the lab where they talk about guns, gear, training, and everything in between. Here are your hosts, Mike and Big Keith, and this is the Gun Experiment.
How's it going, everybody, and welcome to the Gun Experiment. This week, Keith and I talk with the father of modern combatives and discuss the creation of a warrior culture in America. I want to remind everyone that we release new content every Tuesday morning, so be sure to subscribe and share the show with friends. And as always, I cannot start the show without the big man across the table. My co-host, Big Keith, is in the house. Keith, what's going on, brother?
Trying to get my notepad out of the drawer here.
Oh, my God, making a racket.
So did you, our guest tonight, which we're going to introduce in a moment, but he's also from the West Point area. And did you look at the match? Did you see how you did?
I did not.
So do you want to know?
I mean, it probably wasn't great, but you have a smile. Did I do better than you would think I would did?
No, I did better than I thought I was going to do.
I did not look at all.
So I placed 52 out of 84.
Okay.
And
that's pretty good.
You placed 64.
Out of 84?
Out of 84.
Well, it wasn't last.
And we didn't get DQ'd.
Yep. And you didn't shoot a 40 caliber out of a 45.
I did not shoot a 40 caliber out of a 45 this time. I was actually talking to somebody, I just love shooting there.
Yeah.
Shooting at West Point, I just love, the ranges are so, like, they're just top notch.
I mean,
like,
the whole experience was really cool.
Yeah, it was a good time, right?
This is your second time, my first, but I will definitely go back again.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I wanted to share that. And I'd been waiting to look, and then we were just getting ready to get on the air, and I had the light bulb went back off, and I said, oh, shit, let me go check real quick. So I went and checked real quick.
Well, speaking of shooting together, as gun owners, we all love getting out to the range with our shooting buddies, but a good range trip just wouldn't be possible without some good ammo. So New Republic Ammunition from Target Sports USA is just the ticket for your next range trip. It's super reasonable in price, and after shooting thousands of rounds, Heath and I have found it to be very reliable. Sign up for their Ammo Plus membership at targetsportsusa.com, which gets you 8% off all ammo purchases, free shipping, priority alerts, and a whole lot more, all for $95 a year. And I was actually today on the Discord page, Keith, and one of our brethren on there was asking about an upper and what we thought of it. And I was, did you see that?
I did see it.
Yeah. And so I love the fact that there is a community there for people, you know, and that's what I would say is if you're looking to get more deeper down the rabbit hole of the Gun Experiment, make sure you join our Discord page. There is a link on our show notes, and you can always reach out to me on Instagram, and I can send you an invite that way as well. So either one is good. So we're going to get into today's interview. But before we do, today's interview is brought to us by Flatline Fiber Co. Flatline makes sewn goods for the shooting community, including IFEC pouches, slings, ear pro wraps, and dump pouches. I'm always impressed with the attention to detail and focus on customer satisfaction that Flatline is known for. You simply can't go wrong with products that are made in the U.S. and have a lifetime warranty. So check out all of their products at flatlinefiberco.com. And to sweeten the deal, use the discount code GUNEXPERIMENT10 at checkout to get 10% off. So let's get into this thing. Today's guest served in the military, in the U.S. Marine Corps and the 75th Ranger Regiment during the course of a 22-year career in the military. A Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt and member of the Black Belt Hall of Fame, member who is best known as a hand-to-hand combat expert and is known as the father of the U.S. Army's Modern Army Combatives Program. Please welcome Matt Larson to the show. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing great. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks for coming. Thanks for being in the studio. So quick little background here. As everyone who is a regular listener knows, I train jiu-jitsu. We'll get that right out of the way.
early this episode.
Yeah, real early. And my coach, Mike Palladino out of EGA Jiu-Jitsu in Beacon, New York, was having a seminar on some combatives work. And I was like, this sounds really cool. I had just had surgery. I got the old neck slice for the thyroid. And I was like, I can't really do work. You know, I can't risk like this getting opened up. But I was like, I got to go. You know, I got to be there. And I went.
So you sat the sidelines?
I sat the sidelines. I walked around a little bit, kind of checked stuff out, but had one guy kind of rope me into working with him a little bit. So I kind of.
Stay away from your neck.
Yeah, exactly. But met Matt, and I said, I would love to get this guy on the show and talk to him afterwards. And turns out he lives very, very close and was willing to come in studio. So that's sort of the background. And then Matt, you came in today and we kind of hung out on the mats a little bit and talked a little bit. And
got some history lessons.
And so, from the limited amount of time I've spent with you, Matt, it is obvious that you are a wealth of knowledge and that you have a very, very diverse and experienced background. So thank you for coming and sharing that with us.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So let's get into it. As a squad leader in the 2nd Battalion, 75th Range Regiment, and an experienced martial artist, you were charged with creating a practical combatives program. And from what I understand, there was a major shift from jungle warfare of Vietnam to more desert warfare of Iraq and Afghanistan, where in those countries, there was a lot more close combat, a lot more seeing enemy face to face. And so things needed to change. And that's my understanding of it. I don't know if that's
sort of accurate. So what really happened was in the era prior to like the first Gulf War and Somalia and those sort of things, the Rangers were primarily like an infantry, elite infantry units. So we spent all of our time out in the forest and doing raids and ambushes and that sort of thing. And then in the wake of Somalia, the first Gulf War, the invasion of Panama, many of the things that were happening in the late 80s, early 90s, the Ranger Regiment's focus started becoming more and more about special operations. And as it did, that brought us into fighting more and more in urban settings.
Okay.
And so that's really the forcing factor for hand-to-hand combat. If you think about it, you think there was probably more hand-to-hand combat in World War One or World War II?
So, I would think World War II, if I guess.
The answer is actually World War One because of trenches. You know, imagine if you're fighting to take over a hill and you're like laying down machine guns and mortars and all that stuff and you attack the hill, the bad guys run off because they're scared of dying, right? So whenever you are in a trench, you come around the next, 10-foot section of trench, there you are, and the bad guy's there too. And so that same sort of forcing factor as the world becomes more and more urbanized is making hand-to-hand combat more and more common.
Right, and I'm assuming like in the desert, you're in cities, you're in where in, Vietnam was a lot of jungle warfare, right? That was—
Yeah, imagine like the war in Iraq was all fought in cities.
Yeah.
Like it's not like it's a desert country, but out in the desert, there's nothing to fight over. So, right. And then as compared to Afghanistan, Afghanistan was less of that, more
mountain.
Fighting in the mountains, so yeah. Less hand-to-hand combat there than there was in Iraq.
Gotcha. So you're well-rounded in a lot of different martial arts. You're well-versed in boxing, Muay Thai, judo. You've trained in a lot of those, I believe. I'm sure you would agree that all of them would add tremendous value to creating a well-rounded fighter. But you specifically chose jiu-jitsu as the foundation of your combatives program. So what was so special about jiu-jitsu that made you choose that?
Well, so that's a little bit of an answer. So the biggest reason was that it's easier to teach. And what I mean by that, so I did other martial arts first. So I started in karate and judo and then did boxing and then Muay Thai. And then I was always trying to teach my soldiers and Marines those skills, but the learning curve is pretty long on those things. It like takes a while to get somebody some actual skill in boxing or in Muay Thai or something. And it just doesn't fit within the culture of what you're doing in an infantry battalion, your day-to-day life. You're going to do the PT, then you go train other soldier skills. And you don't have the time to put in the hours and hours of training it takes to like digest the boxing moves, et cetera. So jiu-jitsu is much easier. I would say ground grappling is a better way to describe it. Ground grappling is much easier to learn in a short amount of time because you're touching the person. You have touch sensitivity and, there's less dynamic things.
But as a practitioner, I mean, there is a lot to jiu-jitsu. I mean, you can go very deep down that rabbit hole. And so sometimes it feels like obviously the basics are very easy to learn.
Yeah. Well right? Imagine how much, these are all complicated answers.
Yeah, of course.
So we're not going to make it easy for you.
Boxing is pretty simple, right? Intellectually simple. How many punches does the average boxer know or throw and what kind of combinations they throw?
Five, right?
Yeah. It's a very finite thing, right? But the complication comes in how you process information when you're in a boxing match. And imagine when you're standing in front of somebody and you're trying to digest what they're doing through your visual cortex, right? You're taking all that information in, and then the way you process it, it just takes a long time to get the skill set deep enough into your autonomic nervous system so that you can actually pull it off when you're doing it. Whereas when you're doing ground grappling, you don't have to at the early stages, because you can still be in an associative phase where you're like thinking through it by the numbers and it can be effective. You know, like I'll grab his wrist. What's the next step? Well, I'll sit up and intertwine my arm. What's the next step? I'll fall back and then I'll scoop my hip and then I'll have the Kimura.
Yeah.
Right. So you can be effective with much less digestion of the system.
And I guess that is true. And to put it in perspective, that's like when you're a blue belt, which is just above the starting point, right? A white belt's the starting point. And if someone comes in and all things are equal, meaning similar athletic ability, similar age, similar size, those things are all even, and you put a blue belt, which is not very advanced, against someone who comes in day one into a training
You can arena. Mostly whip him every time.
Yeah, every time. I mean, like, it's almost like not even fair, right?
Yeah, and with so, like a year of training, you know, for a soldier, that would be a lot. Like if we got to the point where every soldier was around that level, it would be a miracle, right? But you can become effective much quicker than that.
Sure. Just upper level white belts are actually pretty strong. Right.
I mean, imagine what happens when you, so for the audience, you know, there's a bunch of positions that you go through whenever you're learning how to ground grapple. You know, the mount, if you've ever watched the UFC, you know, the mount, the guard, side position, you know, the back mount, et cetera. And those positions exist in a hierarchy. Like, so when you learn how to fight, you know, this position's better than that one. When I'm here, I should go there. And so when you have that, you know, sort of like map of where you should be trying to go, you can even forget the techniques largely and fight your way towards a position like the mount. Just that sense of objective that you have by trying to do that makes you a better fighter, even if you don't have like the techniques to accomplish it. Because you're doing it against somebody who doesn't have any technique anyway, right? Like what percentage of people in the world are trained ground grapplers? So small as to not be consequential when you're talking about real fights,
right?
So it's a scenario where having some training is better than having
In fact, to compare that to, like, for example, striking skills. When I was my last job in a Ranger regiment, I was what's now called the RASP 2 NCOIC. So that's the when the senior people come back into the Rangers from being out in the regular Army, they have to come in and get assessed again by the psychologists and physical tests, et cetera. So that was my job, do all those tests. And while I had that job, we had all the brand new guys coming into the Rangers who are just like fresh off the street. You know, they go through basic training, they go to, you know, infantry training, and then they go.
Still got some pep in their step.
Yeah, so they come try to be Rangers, right? So you get classes of like 100 people. And, you know, the amount of people who it varies how many make it, but by the time you get there, it's like, you know, 30 or 40 of those 100 will make it past that class. But anyway, nobody's watching. So I used to line those guys up and I would like teach different things to different groups and then have them fight each other. Right? So I did three different times. I did boxing teaching with them. So I used to be a boxer. I've taught boxing 30 years. I was on the Marine Corps. I was on the 3rd Marine Division boxing team when I was young. And so I taught, you know, 6 hours once, and then and then 10 hours another time. And then we hired a local boxing coach to come in and teach 20 hours. And then we taught that to half the class. And then when it was over, we had them box the other half the class. And the other half was just doing PT that time, you know, going for runs and doing push-ups and stuff. And so each of those three times, the team with no training won more fights.
Wow.
Really?
Right. So why that happens is, you know, it's like we're guessing, right? But what I think happens is it just takes a long time to digest that. Meanwhile, the other guys were just going to town, right? They're just being aggressive, right? Yeah. The other guys were like trying to execute the text. Like
trying to learn what they learned.
Right, yeah. Right. The other guys were trying to think their way through it because they weren't far enough into the learning process to be effective, right?
Right.
And so that tells you something.
Like, they knew enough to be dangerous, right?
Right. You can take somebody and give them 10 or 15 or 20 classes in ground grappling. They're already going to be better.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that. So one more question before I know Keith has something here, but a lot of times what I hear from sort of non-believers, and I'm not saying that this doesn't have a hint of truth to it, but there are some limitations with ground grappling, right? So certainly. like obviously the big one is
striking,
multiple combatives, right? Like, so you have multiple people, you're rolling around with one guy and five of his buddies aid.
Everybody has seen the YouTube videos where the kid in the schoolyard tackles his opponent, fights his way to the mounted position, and then some third party comes by and kicks him in the head. So that's true.
Right. So so how do you deal with that in terms of the combatives program, like dealing with that kind of stuff? Because
so the Army has a real handle on how to beat multiple opponents, right? So we've been doing this for 1,000 years. And if you have to fight three people, right, like the way you beat three people is to have nine. Right. So if you have nine guys, you can beat three, right? So yeah. If it's one, look, if you ever try to box against three dudes, you got six arms.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah.
Not really.
Horry and Gracie used to say, you know, you're going to talk about beating three guys and you can't beat one.
Yeah, that's
true. Let's beat one first.
That's right? True.
Where did your call to service in the military come from?
So I've known I was going to be a soldier my whole life, you know. I mean, my...
Just grew up that way?
Yeah, I mean...
Was it a family legacy?
So my grandfathers were both in World War II, you know, so... Mm-hmm. So I guess that's true, but it's more just, like, my parents were very adventurous people, and I always kind of knew that I wanted to do something important, you know? And So soldiering is I don't know. It's a romantic way of life. You know, one of the things about soldiering is like, it's not much different to be in the infantry today than it was to be a Roman legionnaire. Mm. You know what I mean? So yeah, you're still, you know, rucking up,
broad walking miles,
digging holes at the end of the day. You know?
That DNA is is there, right?
Yeah. So I think I was just always, I was always destined to be a soldier. I can't imagine like doing anything else.
And I have to say that if someone is going to go in the military, that's who I want to go in the military.
Yeah.
I want someone that they feel that calling from day one. I don't want someone that like it's forced or they're like, oh, I can get the GI Bill. You know, like I don't want that to be the reason.
I say yes initially when you said that, but you know, on second thought, I don't know, you know, maybe there needs to be more.
So in the principles of war, one of them is mass. And so if you have 400,000 people and you fight 100,000, probably gonna win.
Yeah.
So at some point, you know, that was Napoleon's great innovation. This new Napoleon movie's out. He created the Grand Army, right? He mobilized the population. So if you want to beat another country, you mobilize your population.
Well, and I guess when I say that, maybe I should retract that a bit. The military has a lot of roles, right? And there's probably a role for everybody. But you know, when we're talking about guys that are going out there and doing dirty work, I want someone that really is there. It's invested in, it's part of who they are.
You say that, but you know, when we were talking about prepping for the show, you know, around this topic, you had mentioned, you know, a recruitment issue, right? So that's part of.
So yeah, I had a question about that. So I keep hearing about the recruitment issue that we're just, you know, we're seeing lower numbers.
Yeah. So my opinion, this is just my opinion, right? But my opinion is, look, we just lost two big long wars.
Yeah.
And you know, what happened after we lost the Vietnam War? What after we lost the Korean War?
Recruitment.
Right. And so there's one thing people don't realize is a large part of the recruiting pool is the sons and daughters of soldiers, you know, of former servicemen, right?
Sure.
So
that's why I asked the question.
Of people are like, you know, dissuading their children from going in because
makes sense.
Yeah, and this is the consequence of not winning wars. Mm-hmm. You know, we have somehow as a nation like formed a moral system that doesn't allow us to do the things that were required for victory. Because victory's ugly, right? We're watching this war go down right now in the Middle East, right? Like, okay, what does it take to win?
Right.
Well, one thing it takes is to be, you got to beat the shit out of the people you're trying to fight, right? Like, and so everybody in the world's against that, you know? So.
Well, my question isn't so much, is there a problem or why is there a problem with recruitment? But does low recruitment affect the culture that you're trying to create in the combatives program?
So it doesn't affect it within the Army. You know, the Army now is better, as good as it's ever been, right? It's better than it's ever been. Like the Army keeps getting better. That's true, right? Like it's not as big as it was because of the recruiting issues, but the people who come in, they're still motivated. They're still the right people.
That's good to hear.
I would say the larger issues we have in our like cultural within the whole country.
Yeah.
And that's another good point of what the recruiting issue is coming out of two long wars. That's one thing. The other thing is we say it all the time, we're a very divided country right now, and that's unfortunate. But a lot of times when that's the case, as parents, you might say, I don't know if I want my child being sent to war under these conditions. And that could also be part of his social issues, might be a factor, you know, like I don't know that, but I would, you know, venture to say there are people who don't want to put their kids out there, you know, and would
just, I'm sure that's true. And I also think that we are, you know, we're struggling right now for to find the things that bring us together as a nation.
Yep.
You know, what is it? What are the things that make us, you know, that bring all the citizens together and bind us together as
make
one
us
group.
United States.
Right, right. Yeah.
We just forgot. I don't know.
We've lost our way a little bit. Lost our way, and I don't think that means that we can't find it again, but it's.
I just got done. I read it for the second time. I read it a long time ago and it stumbled back across and I read it again, 1984. And I felt like it's more appropriate now than when I read it the first time.
Yeah.
But we're just blind to, we're so conditioned to believe and see what we think we're seeing, and we can't look past it. And
well, so there's a, you know, what I would say is,
and I don't know if that was too broad, but
what I would say, what has bound us together as a nation over the course of our, you know, history has been the idea of mutually supported freedom.
Yeah.
You know, so we've always fallen short and we always probably will, because, you know, people always are going to have a problem with how other people use their freedom. So,
right.
You know what I mean?
That's a good way to say
that's
it.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, that's the actual challenge. If you want to be down with mutually supported freedom and be free yourself, you must be okay with how other people use their freedom. Yeah. And they're going to use it in ways that you find despicable.
You're right? A hypocrite if you think anything else.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's a great way to put that.
That is a really good way.
And so that's, so I think we're struggling back to that. But the other issue on that is technology, right? Like technology is making.
It's opened us up so
It's making
much.
Tyranny easy, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
I mean, look, who would have imagined in the 80s that every citizen of the country would be carrying a device around with them that tracked all their movements and kept track of all their communications with anybody at all, and that the government, if they wanted to, could get into all of that and know everything you say to anybody, everywhere you've been, everything you ever spent any money on, like all of that, right?
It's almost like 1984 predicted it.
That's exactly right.
Right? Yeah. So bringing this back to combatives, you have said that a warrior should be physically fit, be able to fight, shoot, and apply medical attention when needed. I've listed all of these skills as things civilians should attempt to get proficient at. So I've said this many times, that if somebody were looking to become an absolute asset, and so I'm not talking military here, I'm talking like the average Joe. But if you're looking to be an asset, you're looking to be someone who under, you know, various situations, you could be counted on to be an asset. I've listed all of those things and probably then some. How do you train those skills en masse when limited on time and considering people varying, you know, people vary so much, right? There's different athletic abilities, or different age, size, speed, genetics, all those things. So when you're doing it on a grand scale, like you do in the military, how do you do that? Right? Because you're going to get somebody in that unit that they're just not physically able to. And just really quick, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. But like one of the things you had said was you want someone who's strong enough to be able to carry you out, and you're like, and I'm big, and you got to be able to lift me and carry me out. But, you know, I'll use myself as an example.
You couldn't.
It'd be hard for me. You know, it'd be really hard for me. I'm working on my squats and it'd be tough. Right?
I'm pretty big.
Yeah. So how do you deal with that? Because you're going to get soldiers of all shapes, sizes, abilities.
So those are two different questions. So the first question is, how do we do it in a organization like the Army or police force or the Marine Corps or something like that. And the second one is about how we would do it as individual citizens. Okay. So in the military unit, what you have to do is create a culture that makes demands upon each other. So imagine what does an actual warrior culture look like? Well, in a warrior culture, you know, I can look at the people around me and I'm judging them on their ability to fill their role as my comrade, right? As my colleague. Because my life is on the line. Their strength matters to me because my life is on the line. If they don't fucking get in the weight room, we're going to have issues, right? I'm going to shame them into it. I'm going to push them into it. I'm going to drive them into it, right? If they can't shoot, same issue. If they don't know first aid skills, if they don't know how to land nav, if they don't know the list of skills.
What if I got like three out of the four?
Yeah, then we're going to help you. We're going to help you get the other one, right? Okay. So, yeah, because that's it. So there's two sides, right? The first side is we we demand of each other, right? I demand you be a good enough runner to get to the freaking objective with all your kit. You need to have that much cardio, because if you can't function when we get there, then why the hell would I want you with me, right?
Sure.
And so I'm going to force you to. And on the other hand, I'm going to help you, right? Because at the we can't like suffer a weak link, right? The weak link we have to strengthen.
You're only as strong as
you. Right. Yeah. So that means we're going to come by your room before we go for a run and bring you with us, and we're going to shame you into it, right? Because you must, because our lives are on the line, right? So as a leader, you can do that in the military. You can create that in your organization, and even as like an unofficial leader, you can do that. Just start demanding it of the people around you. Et cetera, et cetera.
Mike, you're not going to shame me into going to jiu-jitsu with you.
Well, listen.
I do the civilian part I want to hold off, because we're going to do a whole segment on that.
Okay.
But what I do want to say is I was listening to one of your speeches in preparation for the show, and the topic came up about saving face was the question. So in other words, how do you save face when you're putting two guys against each other, maybe, you know, two platoon leaders or two unit leaders, and someone's got to lose. And the question was like, how does that person now face their guys and go, like, I lost to another leader. And your answer, I'll let you answer.
Yeah. So the real question is, what is the demand? What do people expect of you? You know, when you get out there on the mat, and it's you and another guy, and you both fight your ass off, and it's a pretty technical fight. Does anybody lose respect for the loser?
No.
Like, absolutely not, right? Yeah. Because what do they see? What they were looking at was your competence and your tenacity, right?
Yeah.
Like, your peers and your soldiers and, you know, your subordinates and whatnot, they can see your soul when you're out there doing something hard. You can't hide from them, you know? And so when you're rolling, you know, nobody actually loses respect for you if you lose. I always tell the story. When we first started the combatants program, we had a commander. His name was Castles. And he was small, right? He weighed like 130 pounds or something. And he was a commander, too, so he was really busy, right? So every time we would roll, he would lose a lot, right? So I always ask, you know, what do you think the soldiers thought of him? Well, they all thought he was a stud.
Yeah.
And they thought he was a stud because he was a freaking stud, right? Like, we saw him bust, you know, trying his ass off, total warrior, you know. That dude eventually was a brigade commander in the 82nd Airborne because he was a hell of a fucking soldier. And everybody knew it, right? Like, it didn't matter that he wasn't the best.
He was squared away and he was a good soldier.
Yeah, you knew you could count on him to be there with you, and he was going to, you know what I mean? Like, he didn't have to be the best grappler. He had to be a good man. And being a good man means the guy who isn't quitting, who's going for it, who's, you know, training, who's...
So on a personal note, because we were talking about Mike Palladino earlier, him and I just had a conversation, and I said to him, I'm having a hell of a time lately. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, I can't find balance. And he said, I don't understand what you're talking about. And I said, I'm trying to get in the weight room 3 days a week in the morning before work. I'm trying to work. I'm trying to like run a podcast, like on a very high level. I'm trying to get here to jiu-jitsu. I'm trying to spend time with my family, be a good dad. And he said, do you do all those things? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, so what the fuck are you talking about?
So you have balance.
He's like, so you're doing it. And I'm like, oh yeah, you're right.
That's right.
Right. But it's like getting after it is the goal. Right. And so I think, what's interesting, that story was very interesting. And in what you said, that it changed my perspective a lot. But in those situations, how do you deal with the person who's struggling? Like, is there a certain point where there's like a weed out phase where you actually lose people in the program?
Well, it depends on the nature of the organization you're talking about, right? If you're talking about institutional,
like in the military is what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So the answer is 9-man squads are better than 8-man squads. We talked about the principle of mass earlier, right? What you really need to do is strengthen the weak links. And there are very few people who are not salvageable. You know, I tell a story all the time. I had this, he'll probably hear this. I had this friend who was one of my privates whenever I was in the 1st Range Battalion many years ago. And he was a guy in another squad, and they were about to get rid of him because he was falling out of all the runs, right? His name was Tony. And I hired him because he was smart, and that's a main thing, right? I knew if he was smart, I could get him along. And so for the first 3 months he worked for me, he fell out of all the runs. And then we finally got a new private in who was weaker than him, and then suddenly, like, he blossomed, right? Within 2 years, he was a best ranger competitor. And just to tell a story, like about 5 or 6 weeks ago, well, first off, he went on to become a Special Forces guy, and then he went to Officer Candidate School, then he became a Special Forces officer, wow. Retired as a Special Forces colonel. And a couple of, like 5 or 6 weeks ago, he ran a 150-mile bike race in Iceland. He's like a semi-professional endurance athlete, you know. Like all he needed was the leadership and the motivation and people to believe in him, and he had the potential to do it all, right?
That's
well,
crazy.
Well, almost everybody does. Like, almost everybody does, you know? Like, the amount of people who don't, I mean, maybe they got like a 60 IQ and they're just not going to be able to do it, right? Like, you just can't overcome that shit, right? But, yeah. But you know, but physically, unless the guy's a cripple or something, and even then, you know.
Yeah,
you
ever heard, I mean, Forrest Gump got over it.
Man, you ever heard of Kyle Maynard, right? He was a wrestler and jiu-jitsu guy in Georgia who, like, had no arms and legs, right? And I've seen him grapple in submission grappling matches like 100 times, and he like submits people left and right with like an arm triangle. I ain't even got arms. You know what I mean?
That's
like,
crazy.
Yeah. He just knows how to work the angles. You know, he can choke you out with his shoulder, you know?
So you have a master's degree in military psychology. And so what does that mean in caveman terms? You know, we talked a little bit about it before we started recording, but how would you really describe that?
So what I describe myself is, so I'm a combat psychologist that takes an evolutionary approach to psychology. So I should be careful. I'm not a clinician, right? So when people say they're a psychologist, like in New York State, it's illegal to call yourself a psychologist unless you're a clinical psychologist. And the reason is because they don't want you to like claiming that you can help people when you can't, right?
So, well, when you're at West Point, you're on federal land, so those
So I want to be honest, right? I mean, I'm open and like, I am not a clinician, right? Clinicians are experts in how to help people who are fucked sure. up, and I'm not that, right? I'm not. if you need help, man, I'm not your guy, right? But you know, more like academically, I study the problems, and so you know, we're at a transition point in psychology, like psychology in general, where the legacy psychology of the 20th century is being replaced by a modern, you know, evolutionary based and biologically based psychology. And, you know, it's quite a profound transition. Though that, and look at all the clinicians, they're still legacy psychologists, right? So best way to describe it is, you know, Darwin described all the people who studied plants and animals before he came along as great observers. Like, they observed lots of stuff and they could figure out lots. They had seen, you know, selective breeding, and they could do like grafting plants onto other plants and whatnot, but they didn't understand why things would be the way they are. And that's the way 20th century psychology is they just don't understand why it would be that way, because there's no like overarching theory that binds it, right? Yeah. Yeah, so evolution is that theory. You know, our brains evolved, and they evolved in our ancestral environment, and we have to like look at that if we want to understand why we are the way we are, and then we can look at how we have changed from that environment to understand a lot of the problems we have.
When you look at our current our current culture, and I'm not looking to go like in a political direction with this. But when you look at how we are currently staged in our country, I often feel as though we are getting, and I'm using this term very loosely, weaker as a society. I feel like we're failing our younger people in a lot of ways. Do you think that is a direct result of being such a prosperous nation for as long as we've been?
Certainly. Also, the more advanced a society becomes, the more and more specialized we become. So let me kind of back up a step and give you a sort of big picture. Imagine hunter-gatherers. Everybody in a hunter-gatherer tribe has to be a hunter, but also has to be a warrior, because hunter-gatherer tribes, you know, humans form coalitions in order to compete over resources, right? So in that era, everybody in the coalition had to be somebody willing to fight or capable of fighting, or else you're just dead wood, right? So imagine among hunter-gatherers, there's no room for Gandhi, because you know, Gandhi's not going to fight when we need you to fight, so hell with that guy. And so in that era, if there was somebody who wasn't willing to be a fighter, they would just like strand them and let them starve to death out away from their group, right? So So that meant that everybody had a sort of ethos that required of that circumstance, right? Okay, so that changed whenever we invented agriculture. So when we invented agriculture, suddenly we had enough.
Abundance of food.
So that we had people who were specialized, right? So we had only a certain amount of the people were involved in the intergroup, you know, fighting anymore. And so when that happened, suddenly we had room for priests and lead, you know, politicians and merchants and all this group. So as we became more and more specialized as a society over the course of many thousands of years, that percentage of people who were actually involved in the fighting shrank and shrank, right?
Yep.
So imagine, imagine first what percentage of our population today is involved in the fighting, like between our group and other groups. So it's pretty small, right?
Yeah.
But even imagine like within the army, you know, there's 1.2 million, I think, in the army right now. So imagine what percentage of those are like involved in like extended combat at the platoon level.
Right.
Such a small percentage as to not be that influential in the culture, you know, and certainly not in our moral systems and whatnot. So with that being said, you know, of course we're getting softer, you know, of course, because where do you learn your morality from? You know, you learn it from your parents. You learn it from all the other adults in your society. You learn it with negotiations from your peers as you're growing up and as you're an adult. Okay, so if everybody in the group's parents are like peaceful people, and all the other adults in the group are also peaceful people, and the society are also peaceful people, why would the children learn what is required to not be peaceful?
So you're saying throw your kids to a bunch of savages and then they'll be okay.
we can affect this in positive ways, right? Yeah. We can talk about that later, but I would say it's natural that we would have more and more of this. And I would also say that we would naturally have less and our moral systems will be less and less connected to the reality of the world. You know, like, in my estimation, like, so I've got quite a bit of combat experience, and you know, combat is like a window into the truth. You know what I mean? When you see horrible shit in combat, right? It's true. Like, this is what the world really is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like nature lovers forget that nature is not only a butterfly, but it's also Ebola.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So the world is the way you feel about your children and love them.
A silverback gorilla will rip you from limb to limb.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
It's nature. It's beautiful, but.
That's right. Chimpanzees fight each other in wars and they dance in each other's viscera when they kill each other, right? Yeah. So it's like, okay, so this is what the actual world is like, right?
Yeah. People forget that.
It's easy to forget when you're. You know, my dad's an electrician, man.
Well, part of it is we really truly live in one of the safest times in human history. And so when it is as good as it is, you forget how bad it could be.
It's funny because, you know, the mainstream news says it's terrible out there. But so we mentioned, you know, you're the director of combatives at West Point, right? That's your official title there.
Correct.
And I'm a huge history buff. I love West Point. I get excited every single time I go there, as we talked about early in the show tonight and in past shows. But what is it like to work with those cadets? Like,
so the cadets are great. Yeah, I mean, all the things that everybody's worried about America. If you could come around, and be around the cadets very much, you would
feel different.
You'd know that we're okay.
Mike and I, we talked earlier on the show. We recently did a two-gun match with the combat weapons team.
Who are also all my students, by the way.
Oh, really? Oh, really? Is that interesting?
Yeah.
Well, so I have to tell you.
They were great guys.
Keith did it last year. He said, Mike, they opened the window. You got to get in. And so I jumped in. We went together. And when we were leaving, literally as we were walking away, I looked at Keith and I said, those cadets are awesome. I mean, just incredible.
And if you see any of them that put on that match, please let them know.
I'll see them all next week.
Yeah. You let them know that you saw two guys that shot that match and we had a blast. They were awesome guys.
Yeah.
And we had a great time.
Yeah. They do a great job. And
there was a couple girls too, but you know, it was awesome.
Yeah. Really good time. And they do a really good job and they are tremendous human beings.
Do you have like a favorite part of West Point? Do you have a place like there that is like...
Oh, the combatives rooms are pretty great.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Well, that's a little biased, but right. anything...
So I work in the gym, right? So our... West Point's a wonderful place. And if I had to say my favorite part of the whole thing would probably be the cemetery, right? Because you can walk around there, you know, it's like Custer's buried there.
There's
the ghosts are around.
Right. Yeah. It's really amazing. And the chapel that they have that's down at the cemetery now, it used to be the main chapel back whenever the school only used to have 150 or 120 students or something. And so now they moved that chapel down there. And so it's pretty magic, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of my favorite places is the museum. I could walk around the firearms museum, and I think they've got one of the best firearms collection, maybe the country. I don't know. It's pretty impressive.
I used to live in DC, so the NRA museum was there. they have a range in the basement there. I used to shoot at all the time.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, they have like an action pistol club that shoots down there, have matches every month, right?
So speaking of schools, you created Combatives University, which is not an actual physical school, but it's online, which has its own belt system. Can you sort of explain what that involves, and can anyone enroll? Is that civilians? Is it just military?
No, it's for everyone.
Yeah. And so explain that to us.
So this is a long explanation.
While he's explaining, can I have a refill?
Of course.
So here's a story, right? So the group of people who created the combative system in the Army. You know, I get the credit for it, but actually it was a bunch of people. And those people have all been training, you know, jiu-jitsu, MMA, combatives for, you know, decades now, right? And so it's a host of guys who are all like black belts and quite experienced soldiers and fighters and many, many years of war experience, et cetera. And we started realizing that the skill set that you want from the guy next to you whenever you're going through the door has emerged not just within the Army, but like around America in all the various groups of people who are tasked with doing the real fighting in the world, right? So that's like the Marine Corps, you know, the SEALs, cops, etc. And in all those groups, like it's recognizable. What do you want the guy next to you to be good at? What do you want? What attributes do you want him to have, right? And so we started reaching out to the other people that we saw who were like the people who are, you know, exemplifying that around these other, portions of our society. You know, like I said, the Marine Corps, cops, et cetera, you know, SEALs and stuff. And, you know, as we all started like getting to know each other and et cetera, we just decided we would bring all these guys in and then just like spread this out, right? So imagine this, right? So the whole system, the Combative University system, it's actually the belt system itself. It's actually about how do you prove that you're one of those guys? And the reason we would say that is because we're trying to motivate people to get those skills that you want that guy next to you to have. So it's all set up like a series of college classes online. How do you become the next belt? You know, gray belt, green belt.
There's four belts, right? Gray, green, brown, and black.
Which mirror the jiu-jitsu belts of blue, purple, brown, and black. But they encompass more. So to get each one of those belts, you have to prove your competence and your ability level.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Can I ask a quick question?
Certainly.
Why did you go gray, green instead of just going blue, purple, brown?
Because they're tactical. Right. Okay. They're actually the colors of the Marine Corps belt system, but they're tactical colors so that you could wear them when you're uniform. Right.
Gotcha.
And there's more to that story. I'll come back on it, but they represent about the same thing. And also one of the problems we were having, right. So let me just back up a step. So when we created the Army combative system, okay, there was four courses, level 1, 2, 3, and 4. The level 1 course was 1 week, the level 2, 2, the level 3, a month, the level 4, a month. So if you add that all up, it's not that much training. It's like 11 weeks of training, right? You know, as anybody who trains all the time knows that if you have like 11 weeks of training, you don't really necessarily know that much, right? And it's institutional training as well. So what can you learn in a certain amount of time in institutional training? So when I set it up, I said, you couldn't go to those courses back to back. The theory was that you would go in between them and do training on your own, and you would gain skill and you'd come back to the next level. And that worked somewhat. But what happened was those courses started to take on like the auspices of rank. You know, people would be like, what level are you?
People want to know, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But the problem was that you could be, you know, a level 4 combatives instructor in the Army with all these 11 weeks of training, still be like a white belt in jiu-jitsu and just get balled up at the local, you know, jiu-jitsu club. Okay, so also there's no quantifiable factor above that level 4. So you got guys who are, you know, third degree black belts who are, according to the Army, the same as the guy who's got 11 weeks of training. Same certification, right?
Right.
So then what started happening in the Army was people started by default using the jiu-jitsu rank structure. So you'd have guys, you know, he's a blue belt, he's a purple belt, he's a brown belt, okay? Problem with that is it only means you're a competent grappler.
Right.
So that's only like one component of what it means to be somebody you need next to you.
We talked about earlier with the shooting and the medical and all that stuff.
Yeah, the guy's a wonderful grappler, but can't shoot, man. He's not really a guy you want with you, right? And if he doesn't know first aid, if he's not strong, you know, he's not the guy you want with you, right? So, and the same thing with all those. And the way Americans mostly train is for hobbying, you know, hobby reasons. So, like, you have lots of people who are like great shooters, can't fight at all, not strong, you know, no, don't know any first aid, and all the skills are like that because they're just doing it as hobbies, right?
Oh, I know. I'm trying to do it all, and it's very hard.
Yeah, that's right.
It's very, very hard.
Look, I joke all the time about it. I always say, look, have you ever been to the SHOT Show, right? SHOT Show's like the home of the size, like 52 5'11 pants, right? Like most of the people there would be better off at a fucking fitness expo if they wanted to defend themselves, right? So
listen, I'm going down from a 52, Matt, all right?
I'm with you, man. Yeah.
You should have saw Keith when I met him.
But so, you know, so the answer is, you know, to be... We want to motivate people across this spectrum, right? And so, and also to like, you know, be able to like give accolades where they belong. So let me tell a longer story to kind of illustrate my point, right? Imagine this, right? Have you ever heard of, everybody's heard of chivalry, right? But what they don't know is that what chivalry actually was nothing to do with what people think it is now. It wasn't about courtesy and how you treat women and blah, 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 blah. Chivalry was the way of the mounted warrior. Cheval means horse in French, right? So it's the way of the mounted warrior. So what was the way of the mounted warrior? What was how you became rich and famous in medieval Europe? Okay, so how did you become rich and famous? Well, some rich fucker gave you land so that you would fight for him. And why would he give you that land? Because you're a badass.
Right.
And how did you prove to him that you're a badass or get this reputation to be a badass so that he would give you the land? You did what was called deeds of arms. So deeds of arms were fighting in tournaments, the joust, fighting in local wars, fighting in foreign wars, et cetera, right? And fighting with, as a, you know, positions of leadership, et cetera. And so if you look at all the source material about what chivalry really was in the actual Middle Ages, it was all about how do you gain a reputation as a badass so that someone will give you money.
How did that get so inverted?
Yeah, well because the Victorians did it on purpose, right? The Victorians turned it into what it is when they were trying to give it out to the regular people, right? And if you look at what all the, that's where it all comes from. It comes from the
1800s, like, right? I feel like my mind is just blown right there.
Yeah,
like,
so the idea is like,
switch.
Yeah. The idea is like in every
I still culture, want my son to be chivalrous, but now I want him to be that way.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah, so in every culture, there's a similar path with a similar set of deeds that you must perform, you know, in order to become successful.
Right.
You know, like if you're like going to be an academic, you have to do these things, right? You got to publish papers, you got to, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's the same across the board, right? Like you want to be a, you know, a big hit on freaking Instagram, you must blah, 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 right? So with that being said, the idea was lay down the list of deeds. And then it's remote, right? So it's like, there's a whole lot of like.
So I went on the website and it looks like you pay for like a module basically, like your gray belt module. And it's like 30 videos. Is that what it is?
So 30? You basically sign up for it like a college class, right? So if you've ever taken an online college class, you sign up for the class and then you're on it. And then you're just on it until you succeed, right? And then all the deeds you must perform, they're like assignments. So if you have to, for example, you have to prove to be a gray belt that you can fight at the blue belt level.
Okay.
Okay, so how do you prove that? Well, you video yourself in tournaments beating people at the blue belt level.
Keith combined, we might be able to get a gray belt.
Yeah, hey, he said like, we didn't have to do well.
because if you've shot a USPSA match or two,
we've shot a couple.
You've had a freaking range master standing right there with you, watching you, making sure you're safe, and you know what I'm saying.
Well, like, he tried to say I wasn't once, but we have video, evidence to show I was fine. Right. Yeah.
We corrected it,
and then for the physical fitness standards, right? So it's mostly strength right now, and we may add to that later, but it's got to be something that you can capture remotely, and so that way it's tied to
you got some possibility there.
I could work towards a gray belt.
There might be like, a 50-year-old level there. You know,
I feel like I could work towards a gray belt.
So the U.S. standard, I mean, U.S. record deadlift in my age and weight class is only 515. So I'm going to beat it probably in the next year.
Or nice.
All right. Nice.
So. I do want to bring this back to guns a little bit. Sure. This is a unique show for us. We're talking a lot more combatives work than we are guns.
You're loving it.
I'm loving it. I love it. I think I sort of know the answer to this, but I'm kind of leading a bit. If I'm carrying concealed, and I think about this all the time, I'm walking around in the grocery store. I've often said that if something happens, someone gets a little, starts cracking wise, maybe insult your girlfriend or your wife. I've often said that the guy who's carrying is probably less dangerous in that situation than the guy who's not.
Yeah, because you're forced to be a grown up.
If I'm carrying, I'm probably going, you know what, man? Call my wife whatever you want. We're leaving.
You know what I tell everybody about fighting like that? So here's something everybody should know. Who's the most dangerous guy? Low status men. Right, low status men are much more prone to violence than high status men. The reason they're much more prone to violence is because they have everything to lose, and I'm sorry, they have everything to gain by being violent and nothing to lose. If you take a guy who's like, you know, he's got a house in the burbs and he's got a good job and he's like living a good life, if this guy gets involved in violence, he might lose everything, right? Okay, the other guy who's got nothing, right? The only thing he's got is his reputation as a tough guy. That fucking guy will die to keep that reputation.
Yeah.
Right? So
that's a really good point.
Right. So in every society in the world where low status men who have no way to gain status like reasonably easily, right?
Yeah.
They will resort to violence. So imagine
That's a really good point.
Yeah. What are the options we give like a low status man who's born in our country, right? Into like a poor family, worst part town. Okay, so here are the options. He can be go into sports. Okay, so that's gonna last him till high school probably, probably not beyond, but some people will last beyond that, and then a very, very little bit beyond that. But at some point that will end and he'll be back to being low status again, right?
Yep.
Or we can be
other than the like top 1%.
Right.
The NFL player, the NBA player.
Yeah. Right.
MLB
those guys
player.
Are so small.
That's
so
that
small.
Little bit more that he talked about outside of college. Right.
Yeah.
So then the other one is you could be a dork and have no status at all as your child. You're not going to get any girls whenever you're 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. By the time you get out of school, get a decent job, eventually you could do that guy, but you're going to have to forego all status in the meantime because everybody's going to think you're a dork. So that's the second option, right? And the third option is be violent.
Right.
That shit works now. Who gets the freaking girls in a bad part of town?
Mm-hmm. Violent.
Right. Violent guys, right?
Yep.
So if your whole thing that makes you a person of note in this world is to be a violent guy, everybody be afraid of you, then you'll freaking risk your life.
Yeah. One of the things I've always talked about is people who do well in business. There's people who go through, you know, they go to a good business school, they work their way up through the system. But there's an advantage to having nothing. Because if you have nothing, you have nothing to lose.
Nobody and hustles like a crackhead.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so people who have nothing to lose, they'll start businesses, they'll lose businesses. It doesn't matter because what do they have to lose, right? They have everything to gain, nothing to lose. So very similar concept. Yeah, but I do think there is something too for the listener out there. If you're carrying and you are in close quarters, you're you know people are in your face. It behooves you to walk away, to back up.
Yeah,
It
forces you to be an adult because
it's a good way to put it.
You know.
Yeah. So my last question is even farther from combatives. Like, well, maybe not. I guess. You've made your mark on a few different books, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to to give our listeners maybe your top pick of the one they should read, or, and maybe a runner up to that.
Of mine,
and if it's not yours, one that you like, or that you think everybody should read.
The top book of mine to read is a book about snipers that I did with my second wife, Gina. It's a very good book. She was a good writer. If you want to know what being a sniper was like in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's pretty good, you know.
Okay. What's the title?
It's called Snipers, America's Single Shot Warriors in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yep. I saw that.
Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah. It's a good book. She was a very good writer, and she wrote for Army Times. She was a war correspondent. That's how we met. So I would recommend that of mine, right? I think that the rest are how-to manuals, you know. My book on combatives, which is hard to get, it's basically the story of how the combatives program evolved, and it's actually trying to be lessons about how you would train organizations and units based upon my lessons learned as I went. So it's a good book. It's not that big. Believe it or not, all my intellectual energy these days is about how we it's about psychology of combat and how we how we train people to be ready for combat. And I don't mean that as in to be successful in combat. I mean as in to be mentally ready for combat and the aftermath.
Yeah.
You know, and that is a...
We've been talking a lot about that, I think, on the show recently in general. But
yeah,
there is a huge burden of mental capacity that comes with that, right? And I don't think people really understand it.
Yeah, so this is actually my main focus these days, academically and intellectually is that it's about, so imagine, you know, we are finding out recently that like most of what we used to label as PTSD is actually moral injuries, right? A moral injury is when you have a deeply held belief that gets destroyed by events. Mm-hmm. Okay. So most of the psychology field, they don't understand how to deal with it because their a priori, like their assumption is that the people's morals are correct.
Could you do me a favor? Could you give the analogy of and I don't mean to be blunt, but killing a child
I'll give you an example. That's a great one. So just, we talked about this before for the listeners. You know, so imagine this, you grew up your whole life thinking that like killing children is bad, right? Okay. So this happened in Somalia, not to me, cause I wasn't in Somalia, but this happened to my friends there, right? So then the bad guys, like they don't have enough guns to go around. So you shoot one of the bad guys in the street and they send another man out to get his weapon. And so you shoot him. So then they send an 8-year-old out, you know, the first time you let him get away with it, but then your life is on the line. You're going to die if you let him keep getting away with it. So pretty soon you shoot the kid. And then, you know, now you got to deal with that like forever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so
it goes against what you've been raised to believe is wrong.
So are then the bad guys like line up behind their women and children and move towards you down the street, shooting from underneath their armpits and whatnot. And it's, you know, it's not gonna be too long before you mow them down with machine gun fire. Right. And you kill all those women and children.
I can't imagine what they tell the women and children to convince them that
they got guns.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Right? I guess that's true.
Listen, one of my friends was killed in the early part of the war in Iraq. A couple came up to his, blocking position that he was monitoring or hovering as a man and a pregnant woman. And the pregnant woman got out of the car and she was hollering in Arabic and he ran over to see if he could help her. And then the guy kicked off the car and blew them both up and killed him. Right. Shh. Well, it turns out that he had kidnapped this pregnant woman. And so they would look like a family and she was jumping out hollering for help from her kidnapping. Right. But so what I was trying to say earlier about like war being a window into the truth, like this is the fucking truth about the world, right? Like it's actually like this. And so if your moral system that you grew up like in, you know, the suburbs in America can't handle that shit, then you're going to be fucked up for the rest of your life, right? So the key thing on that is you got to like deconstruct your morals and understand why you have them. You know, why is it that you believe the things you believe? Because this is what I was saying, like the world of psychology, like everybody like assumes that war is an anomaly and peace is normal, but that isn't true.
No.
Like war is normal.
Yeah.
Right? Peace is an anomaly. You know, everything in nature dies a horrible death and is eaten.
Yeah.
Right? Like everything. And so yeah. our ancestors grew up in that world, and that's what our brain is actually adjusted for. And then we have, it's like diseases of civilization, right? We were grown up, we were evolved eating, you know, mostly meat, et cetera. And then now we eat a cake. And so we're fat and we have diabetes, right? I do too, right? Well,
violence is natural. Peace was created.
Correct.
Right?
And the moral systems that evolve in peace are unnatural.
Yes.
You know, like hunter-gatherer man doesn't have room for Gandhi, man, because he's dead wood.
Yeah.
A motherfucker won't fight.
Yeah.
They just kick him out into the wilderness, right? Let him die. So what we have to do, because we're living in the modern world, what we have to do is we have to deconstruct our morals, and we have to like understand what we actually have to, what the truth is, because it's not just, like, we're not trying to be Vikings. We're not like going out and like, you know, raping nuns, you know what I mean? Like you have to be the sort of person who can live in our society, but also be victorious in war.
Well, it's what you mentioned earlier of like the person who has everything to lose. You have to be a civilized person. You don't want to lose.
Or you lose everything.
You lose everything.
Right.
But at the same time, you don't want to lose complete and utter ability to realize that violence is a reality.
Yeah, I mean, look, I got a lot of combat time. I've seen a lot of horrible shit. You know what? I don't have any trouble. And the reason I don't have any trouble is because I understand the world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I understand the world in such a way that I know that I'm going to like fit into this society. I'm going to raise good children to be good people. I'm going to hold down a good job. I'm going to, you know what I mean? Like I'm going to do all that stuff. And I was all about kicking that ass when it was needed, right?
It's a good place to live, right?
Right.
Yeah. So where can people find you? I have a ton of links in the show notes, but give us where people can find you.
The best place is combativesuniversity.com. And if you can get a hold of that, combativesuniversity.edu, or I'm sorry, .org.
Cool. So we're going to do some run and gun. It's 10 questions, rapid fire. You let me know when you're ready.
I'm ready.
All right, here we go. Keith, you good?
Yeah, man.
Number one, what is your favorite gun in your personal collection?
Well, I live in New York, so I only have my deer rifle with me.
What gun?
It is a Winchester Model 70 in 270 Magnum.
What gun would you buy if money was no object?
I'd get a Bill Wilson freaking Ultra.
If you could have a drink with one person living or dead, who would it be?
Living or dead, Chesty Puller.
Favorite caliber?
9mm.
Favorite hobby, not gun related?
Fighting.
If you could have one superpower, what would it be?
Say that again?
If you could have one superpower, what would it be?
Omnipotence.
All hell breaks loose. Is it better to be armed or trained?
Yes.
Is it better to be loved or feared?
Yes.
Rifle, pistol, or shotgun?
Rifle.
You're in the worst scenario imaginable. Who do you want to have your back other than your significant other?
Damian Stilley.
Let's mix it up.
Keith?
57.35.
Put some?
Bottom third.
Okay.
Bottom third.
Okay.
He's with Alan Gottlieb. Okay. You know, Bill Blowers is out there.
I will say yes was answered twice, and that's never been said before. So you got that going for you. All right. So Let's Mix It Up is brought to us by 4patriots.com. For months, you've heard Keith and I talk about how much we've enjoyed the product and how great they've been to work with. They offer survival food and so much more. And now they've done something awesome just for our listeners. The folks at 4Patriots set up a special page for you at 4patriots.com/gunexperiment10 so that listeners of this podcast can get weekly discounts and deals. But act quickly because the deals will change each week. Remember, head to 4patriots.com/gunexperiment10 each week and grab those deals. So on this episode of Let's Mix It Up, we discuss the process involved in creating a warrior culture in America. And I want to really tighten this up a bit. We've talked a lot about your combatives program in the military, but I want to talk about how we can specifically do this for the civilian culture and kind of harden ourselves a little bit for people outside of the military.
Okay, great.
So starting off, some principles that I read about that you sort of outlined for the military was needing to control the culture, cohesion, and positive culture within the military and the combatives program. So my first question, I guess, or where I want to kind of let you loose a bit is, how do we apply those things to civilians?
All right, so we have
to- And that's a tough question.
No, it's easy, actually. So thought a lot about this. You know, my training in psychology taught me some pretty significant things. One of them was there are three paths to happiness, or three ways to get to like genuine happiness. So this is a good thing for everybody to know. First one is savoring the moment. So savoring is like, you know, check it out, man. This is awesome. Like, I just met you guys. We're having whiskey. We're having a great conversation. You know, like here's to it, right? Like, this is wonderful. Let's like stop for a second and appreciate how wonderful it is, right? And it's the same thing as like you're out to dinner with your significant other and there is, you know, red wine, sunsets, awesome. You know what I mean? You're having time with your children, whatever. So that's a skill, you know, that you can like practice, like appreciating the wonderful things.
It is a skill.
Right.
Definitely.
Definitely is a skill.
We move fast in this world.
Right.
Yeah. But
so you have to like appreciate it, right? So that's one way towards like to have some happiness, like real happiness. Another way is flow state, right? So flow state is like when you live in the moment, right? So when you're doing something like skydiving or jiu-jitsu or you're on the range or you're painting or you're, you know, there's a lot of things where they are so engulfing, right? Like that you're so into it that you're not thinking about your bills, right? Like when you're rolling in jiu-jitsu,
so true.
Like nobody, when the guy's trying to break your fucking arm, you're not thinking about all your problems.
And so that is very true. You're never more in the moment than when you are grappling.
Yeah. So what's happening when you're in flow? I'm sorry.
I was going to say it doesn't have to be grappling.
Many paths to flow state, right? Like I said, it could be painting, right? Like you're so into it that you're just so enraptured by the moment, right? That you're just,
Heath, do you have something right, that
doesn't? Well, you have to find it for yourself.
Right.
I mean, I have a couple things. I mean, you know, obviously everyone knows I'm a FUD, shoot and shot.
Right.
Shotgun, trap, ski.
I could see that.
You know, shooting any competition.
Driving
is definitely another one. The thing that distracts me the most is something I don't do anymore, but I've talked about it on the air a couple times. It's flying. I that was the one time that I can really, when you describe what that is like, not savoring that moment, but
flow state
is, it's that.
Yeah.
I fucking took this thing off. I gotta land this fucking thing without dying.
Yeah.
You know, I can't think about anything.
You gotta be in that
moment.
No, exactly right, because the stakes are high, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah, so flow state is one, right? And so what's going on when you're in flow state? Just so that everybody is tracking, the reason why this is a thing is because what you're really doing is retreating back to your animal nature. But this is also why people are attracted to like drinking and drugs and et cetera. It's because when you're on heroin, right, like you're not thinking about your bills.
You're in a different flow state.
Right. Never done it, but it sounds like you would not be worried about that.
You know what I mean? So that's that. All the drugs and shit that we abuse, they all give us flow state. So it could be positive or negative.
It's also why powerlifters, jujitsu, you're talking about flying. Those people have very similar traits to the heroin addict. Mm-hmm. They really do. I mean, I'm not saying
addictive things. Those are all addictive things, right?
Yeah.
Like you're going to the gym and you're like lifting heavy stuff. And like, exactly right.
So it's getting addicted to something.
Well, it's what is addictive about it is the flow state. It's the freeing of your mind from anxiety, et cetera. Right?
But you got to find that for you.
Right. And find it in a way that's positive.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
the challenge. So, but the problem with both of those things, even when it's positive flow state and savoring the moment, is they're both ephemeral, right? So when you leave the jiu-jitsu gym, you have like an endorphin high for a while.
Sure.
But eventually you're back to your daily life. So the third way, and this is the key, the third way is to have a meaningful life, as in you're serving some higher purpose, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so when you're serving some higher purpose, like you can blow off all the little shit in life because this thing is more important, right? Like,
right.
So that is genuine happiness, right? So with that being said, when you're serving, like when you're a soldier, like being a soldier comes with that. Like it's a higher calling, right? There's something bigger going on. Okay, so when we have trouble with people like committing suicide and whatnot is when they get out. Because when you retire or you get out of the army or et cetera, suddenly you don't have that anymore. So this guy who was like, you know, serving this higher purpose is suddenly like working at a warehouse or,
you know, I've heard this before where someone, well, the classic and it's fictitious, but it's a good example was the Rambo movies. And if you remember the Rambo movies, there's a point where he talks about, you know, the guy's walking through a town and he gets, you know, basically harassed. And he says to Troutman in that movie, he says, I was driving $30,000 pieces of equipment. Yeah. And now I'm basically
I guarded nuclear weapons in the Marine Corps. When I got out, I was qualified to be a fucking mall guard.
Right.
Like for real. That's a true story, right?
Yeah.
So
it's demoralizing in a way. Right.
And so here's another thing about that, right? Which is that like suicide is a contagion, right? So what I mean by that is the Army found out when they had their anti-suicide classes that like they're going around the Army trying to prevent suicide, they actually had a spike in suicides everywhere they had these classes because it's a contagion, right? Like you suggest the idea. It's like, don't think about a red truck. So every listener is thinking about a red truck, right? So the best ways to counter that are indirect. You can't like bring it up directly, right? Mm. Okay, so now with that being said, how do we give people a sense of mission?
So let me redirect this. How do we give people a sense of mission in a civilian world?
No, this is my point, right? So we're starting with veterans, but we're going to push it out to everybody else. Okay, when you're sitting in a restaurant, is everyone around you safer and better off because you're there?
Oh.
Like they are, right?
Question.
No, they are. They are. They
this
are.
Is one of your, this is one of your quotes, by the way.
Right. No, they this, are can, because.
Can you give the direct quote? Can you give your actual quote?
I don't remember it.
I'm going to look it up.
All right. Well, keep going. Right, so listen, they are safer.
They're safer because you're trained. Because your marksmanship skills, your first aid skills, your fighting skills, your like. But those things make the people around you safer, right? Because if there's a mass shooter comes into that building and you're in there.
I want to go through the kitchen.
No, you don't, man. You'd be a warrior. You close with the enemy, man.
Well, Matt.
You have a duty. You have a duty, right?
I get you. I don't disagree. I feel confident in that ability to protect myself. That is why I choose to carry, right? And things like that in New York where you're allowed, which is today in the studio.
In your home.
In my home, right. In my car. There's also, we talked about this off air, that idea of walking away and that idea of not getting involved.
Yeah,
right?
So here's
where I'm challenging a little bit.
No, I'm with you on that. But listen, so do you have a duty to protect your fellow man? Right. What I'm getting at is this, right? So
you have the call to being a soldier. So
right. So what I'm trying to say is, look, soldiers all know they do.
Yeah.
Right. And so when you're talking about that veteran community, et cetera, the answer is, of course, all of them, yes.
Sure.
Because they've already been there. They're already served. So hold on. So that's a easy step to be able to say your mission didn't end the day you left the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Your mission remains. So, you know, we've all heard the sheepdog thing, right? Which was Dave Grossman's you know, he said there was three kinds of people. There were sheep and wolves and sheepdogs, right? And I understand his analogy, but I don't like it, right? Mm. And the reason I don't like it is because why do the sheepdogs protect the sheep? If they don't give a shit about sheep. And if there was no shepherd around, they'd probably eat the sheep, right? They do it because they love the shepherd. So there's a Christian analogy there that's worth considering, right? Mm-hmm. But it also puts the sheepdogs separate from the sheep, right? I like this analogy better. Why do the bulls protect the herd? Well, the bulls protect the herd because they love the herd. It's their family, right? Mm. So the bulls have a duty to protect their women, their children, their colleagues.
I found your quote.
Okay.
Being the warrior in the room means that every other person is safer because you are there.
Right? It's true, right? So
is it though? But is that always true?
It is if you're a warrior. You know, so I started thinking this about veterans, like how do we give them a sense of mission, you know, and that's the bull in the herd, right? You should be the warrior in the room. You should be thinking about being the bull in the herd. Your mission doesn't end the day you get out. Your mission continues because you are still responsible for protecting the herd, right? You are still there
And how does that relate to a civilian?
Because there's actually no difference between the veteran and the civilian in regards to that. Because absolutely, look, you know, when a herd of Cape Buffalo are attacked by lions, right? Who defends the herd? The bulls and the freaking tough cows, man. And they freaking fight to the death. They, of course, are afraid of the lions, right?
Yeah.
Because they're just regular bulls, right? Yeah. Like regular buffalo.
And it's a fucking lion.
It's a lion, right? And so that's us, right? And what do? We make ourselves as tough as possible. We freaking train. Look, if you only know first aid, if you only know that, and you're not like down with guns, you know how to fight, the people around you are better off because when their shit goes down, you'll be freaking there.
And that goes back to that quote that I stated earlier that is your quote. And like, you want to be an asset, right? Mm-hmm. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
So I want to ask this question. It's a very important question for me personally. And Keith, I think you'll resonate with this as well. Keith and I both have young children. I have a son who is 7. My daughter is 5. Keith, your children?
8 and 9.
Man, with whiskey in us, that is impressive. We spit that out that quick.
Don't ask me their birthdays. So I'm just kidding. I know what they are.
I have, including stepchildren, I have 9 children.
Wow. Good for you.
Good for you.
And many, many grandchildren.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing.
2 pregnant daughters right now.
Oh,
congratulations.
Man.
Fucking hell yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So then this is a good question for all of us then.
Right.
So how do we start to instill the warrior ethos in our young people? Because I look at my son and I look at my daughter and my daughter just started, my son was wrestling.
She's the warrior.
My daughter just started wrestling. Yeah. And like, I'm like, she's a ballerina on one day and she wrestles on the other day. And I fucking love it. And I love it, you know, how do we do this?
This might not be the answer you want, but it's the actual answer. So there's a 3-step process. So there's 3 phases to the psychomotor learning process, no matter what skill you want to teach him, jiu-jitsu, shooting, juggling. Okay. The first one is the associative phase. That's where you show them the technique. The second one is the first one is a cognitive phase. When you show them the technique, they got it intellectually and they force their body to do it. Second one is the associative phase. That's where you practice it, right? It's from the behavioral school psychology. Behaviorist school psychology. So that's when you move it from short-term to long-term memory. So you know it intellectually, but you won't ever forget it. And the last one is the anonymic phase. And the anonymic phase is when you've moved it so deep into your memory that it's in your autonomic nervous system.
And
so it becomes automatic, right? That's the portion of your nervous system that doesn't require conscious thought.
Slamming on the brakes in the car.
Yep.
Like when a hockey player is skating to the ice handling puck, what are they thinking about? It isn't fucking skating, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so with that being said, moral learning works the same way. You introduce moral concepts to someone and then you put them in the associative phase, which is where they are tested all the time on moral questions, and they are reinforced positively and negatively. And so those things like are deep.
But eventually you're talking hard skills.
Hold on. I'm talking moral skills. And then eventually they just become a moral person where they make the right decision. Right? So here's what I would say. Okay. So you don't have to teach your children to be warriors. You have to teach them to be good people, and you have to teach them to be good people with your warrior window into morality. Look, our morality must be the sort of morality that allows for victory, but also allows us to be good people who can operate in society, right?
We have people in this world that are different. Their opinions are different. Their likes and dislikes are different. But the reality of it is we've become very divided. And what will unite us, what will bring us back together is exactly what you're talking about. The idea that, Keith, you said it at the West Point shoot, and you said, I bet you some of these cadets politically maybe don't align with you and I.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm
right? Sure and that, I said, yeah. But you know what? How kick-ass were they? How awesome
they were
they?
All
how,
awesome.
How, yeah, you, how you, awesome were they?
You find that there for sure. Like, we have a really diverse. Like,
yeah.
And I mean that in like in every way you could imagine diversity, right? Like,
yeah.
So they are from all walks of American life, yep. and they are high achievers, and they are good moral people. And look, believe it or not, man – Look, West Point's mission is to provide warrior leaders of character to the force and good citizens to the country, right? So
well, that's what I said to Keith. I said, I don't care what lever they push when they vote. I care that they fucking kick. They were awesome.
That is, I think, the problem is that we've got to stop putting so much focus on what lever you choose.
Yeah, yeah. So
West Point's a good window into that because every one of those kids, like, look, and they're there for all different reasons. You know, many of them there for reasons that are more selfish than others and et cetera. And that's all true. But, you know, look, here's the actual question. When was the last time you heard about some West Point graduate who was involved in some big ethical, you know, moral scandal?
I can't remember.
Well, it happens, right?
There was last year, there was a drug issue with some West Point cadets. Right,
but they're still cadets. So I'm not talking about cadets. I'm talking about graduates, right? Yeah. Because a cadet is somebody who's still being molded, right? Yeah. So when you get a kid in.
I can't think of a graduate.
You get a kid in and he's been a stellar performer in like Poughkeepsie or someplace, and he comes in and he's a freshman. Okay, he's not our product. He's not our product until he graduates, right? He's in the middle of the process in that time. But whenever you have somebody who's a graduate and they spent, you know, the 4 years plus that it takes to get through that place, right? Okay, by then, that process we were just talking about you tell them, you know, what's right. You test them. They're in a million circumstances where they have to make the right decision. And then at the end of the day, they digest it and they become those sort of people. That's actually what the whole point is, right? Yeah. Because we're talking about leading our army. What do you actually need to lead your army? What you actually need is people who are good people, right? Yeah. So our graduates are good people.
Which goes back to the idea of building a warrior culture amongst our young people.
Yeah. And that's the point I was trying to make, don't worry so much about building a warrior culture among your children.
Make them good people.
Make them good people. Make them good moral people. And why, look, the discussion we just had about morality, what does it mean? Okay, so what you need to do is like think about that heavily. Like, what does it mean to be a good person?
100%. Matt, I want to thank you for joining us in the studio today and discussing combatives with us. Your dedication to building a strong warrior culture is not only admirable, but in my opinion, needed more now than ever. It's always an honor to discuss a topic with someone on the top of their field, which certainly you are. And I hope many of our listeners will be able to apply your warrior ethos to their everyday lives to help build a more capable nation. And to everyone listening, we thank you again for taking time out of your day to tune into our show. You can find links in the show notes to all of our social media, so be sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Discord, and Spotify so we can keep the conversation going. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.